Hi, I'm Marco Werman. You're a fan of the world, so you already know that we've been tracking the coronavirus story since the beginning. Along the way, we have tapped a network of doctors, epidemiologists, and public policy experts to give you the context, latest news, and practical information you need during a pandemic. Our reporting on the coronavirus is free to listeners and readers. Our coverage has never been behind a paywall, ever. But let's face it, this kind of critical reporting is expensive to produce, which is why we're asking for your support today. Together, we can make sure nonprofit journalism is available to everyone. Please go to theworld.org/give and contribute, or follow the link right here in the episode notes. That's theworld.org/give. And thanks. The toll of the pandemic grows, hospital supply chains and parents under strain. In China, a 250 million students, the entire school system online.
The learning curve, especially in the first couple of weeks, was massive. It was like a learning cliff.
The International Criminal Court will look at possible U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan, but Mike Pompeo says, not on my watch.
This is an international court, and here you have the Secretary of State literally singling out staff members of that court publicly and threatening them.
And a kid from Mexico moves to Virginia.
I had no friends. It was hard to make friends. And then there wasn't that many Mexican people there. And so what do? I dance.
He breakdanced right into the Olympic Games, but not in 2020. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories today on The World. We begin today with this public service announcement.
Stay at home.
That's U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Jerome Adams speaking earlier today. He warned that the coronavirus outbreak will get worse in the U.S. this week and that Americans are not doing enough to stop the spread.
We're not going to ventilate our way out of this problem. We're not going to treat our way out of this problem. The way you stop the spread of an infectious disease like this is with mitigation measures and preventing people from getting it in the first place. And so while we are focusing on supply, we also need to focus on driving down demand this week. We need more people talking about, hey, stay at home.
That's the message for this country, for everyone. It's a message Italians have been heeding for nearly 2 weeks. Still, Italy has the most reported deaths of any country in the world. What does that look like? Well, the Italian army is ferrying coffins to remote areas that cannot keep up with the growing death toll. Stefano Magnone is a doctor at the Papa Giovanni 23rd Hospital in Bergamo, Italy's hardest-hit city in the country's north. Dr. Magnone just returned to work today after successfully battling COVID-19. He says his colleagues at the hospital are still getting sick with the virus.
Some of them are in the ICU as patients. We are seeing many doctors falling ill with this infection. The majority of them is at home with mild symptoms, but a small number of them are in the ICU.
How do you fill the holes when those doctors fall sick?
I think every doctor can feel the fear of getting sick with this virus. We doesn't forgive anyone, doctors, nurses, young people, elderly. So we know that the majority of the death are elderly, but we can experience the fear. We have more or less 80 beds in the ICU. All of them are occupied by patients with the virus. And we are opening a new ward in the hospital for more patients. The same situation is in all the hospitals of the east part of Lombardia.
So how are the other doctors at the hospital and other medical professionals coping right now?
Well, we recruited more or less 40 new doctors in our hospital. Two fields hospital are being under construction in these days, one in Milano and one here in Bergamo.
We're hearing about awful existential decisions that doctors are having to make. For example, not giving a ventilator to people over 60 if there's a choice between giving it to somebody who's younger and in a bad situation. So what kind of choices have you and your colleagues been forced to make recently?
Well, I read this kind of news, but I'm not sure that they are true because, the age is not a single factor for you to decide which patient has to go to the intubation or not. We are experiencing a lack of resources. This is true. Some of the patients that need ICU beds are sent to other region in the south, which at the moment has the capability to cope with the patient that we are not in the position to treat. It's very difficult to set a line for this kind of decision. So we are trying to do the best for everyone.
Well, thank you very much for clarifying that. So the fact that you're sending some patients to the south of Italy in the middle of this lockdown, that would suggest that they have the space and the capacity to help people. So you would say this lockdown, the effects of it are working.
Well, this is a hope for that, because we are not until now seeing the benefits of the lockdown, because as far as we know, the incubation period is maybe more than 14 days. Yesterday, we saw a difference in the rising of the new patients. So, I mean, a single day is not significant. But we are reaching the end of the second week from the lockdown, so we have to be optimistic in that.
Mm. To that point, the rate of mortality in Italy has surpassed most other countries in the world. Can you help us understand why?
Well, this is a very difficult question. We see a very high absolute number of deaths. This is true. But we don't know how many people got the infection. We don't know that. So it's very difficult in this moment, at the moment, to have a correct rate of deaths.
Right. Yeah. Finally, Doctor, what message do you have for those of us here in the United States, given that this country seems to be just a couple of weeks behind the terrifying trajectory that Italy has followed?
The only thing that people have to do is to stop working, to stay at home, and try to see no one for the next 2 to 3 weeks. Testing is very important if you have to identify the contacts and separate the positive patients. But the main thing to do is to isolate all the people, each other.
Stay at home and see no one for the next 2 or 3 weeks.
I think so. Yeah. We didn't lock all the country as a first decision. No one has the right decision in the pocket. I mean, this is a completely new disease, so it's very difficult.
Dr. Stefano Magnone with the Papa Giovanni 23rd Hospital in Bergamo in northern Italy. Thank you once again for being with us.
You're welcome.
In Europe, Italy is first, then comes Spain with more than 33,000 coronavirus infections. Over 2,000 people there have died from COVID-19. The country is now under lockdown. Spaniards can go out for food, medical care, or emergencies. That's basically it. Rule breakers face fines of more than $1,000. For some Spaniards, there is an escape, but it also brings risk with it. Lucia Benavides reports.
If I was at home, I'd be cooped up in my small apartment in Barcelona. It's a nice place, but I'm feeling very lucky to be here. I'm in a small town called Moya, about an hour and a half away from the city. Here, I can walk through the woods with my dog Rumba. It's one of the few times I get to go outside while we're on quarantine, letting our dogs do their business. People have houses and yards in Moya, and nature nearby. It's very different from being in a city like Barcelona right now, where many don't have outdoor space, or sometimes not even a window that looks out onto the street. In Spain, rural towns have emptied as young people moved to the cities for jobs and university degrees. But in recent days, there's been a mass exodus, only in reverse. People who could leave the cities have come to places like this. 22-year-old Arman Castañ is one of them.
No, en general la gente que tiene familias en los pueblos, la mayoría de gente subió a Moya.
Castañ says those of us who have family in small towns came here to be with them. While both of us are in the same town, we can't meet face-to-face because of the quarantine, so we spoke over video chat. Castañ studies at a university in Barcelona, but classes are suspended.
Es como que realmente donde tienes como el sustento.
During times of emergency like this, he says, people go where their emotional support is. Castañ was raised in Barcelona, but his extended family lives here in Moya. He says he worried about bringing the virus out here himself. So he says he's trying to limit physical interactions with people as much as possible. In Moya, the streets are fairly empty. Usually you see pedestrians in this area, but there aren't many out and about right now. Most are doing their food shopping. Some are wearing masks and keeping their distance. The usual chatter of teenagers walking in groups and people eating and talking in cafes is gone. As for the influx of city folks who've come here in recent days, some of the locals are not that happy about it.
Es un poco egoísta, ¿no?
51-year-old Yolanda Bordeaux says it's a little selfish, isn't it, for city people to flee here. Bordeaux works at a retirement home where new rules prohibit outside visitors. She's mostly upset at the families that are out here for the simple comfort of having more space. Some houses in Moya are vacation homes owned by those who spend their summer months outside the city.
Nosotros en comarcas no tenemos...
We don't have the kind of health services here they have in Barcelona, Bordeaux says. The nearest hospital is half an hour away, and even there they lack some equipment. The most serious cases are sent over to Barcelona.
Colapsar este sistema tan mínimo de gente que te ha venido de fuera.
Bordeaux says she worries about the influx of outsiders collapsing the local healthcare system. Hospitals and clinics across Spain are already straining to keep up with the rising number of coronavirus cases. But there are signs of cooperation in Moya. People are coming together to organize support networks. They're delivering food and supplies to those in vulnerable situations who can't leave their houses for fear of putting their lives at risk, or offering childcare services to those who still have to work. Bordeaux says she hopes these difficult times will help everybody learn to live in community.
Pero nos tendría que ayudar a no ser tan individualistas, ¿no?
It should teach us to be less individualistic, she tells me, and to think about what we can do to help those around us. For The World, Lucia Benavides, Moya, Spain.
The fight against the coronavirus is also a race for medical supplies, masks, ventilators, life-saving medical equipment. A lot of that equipment comes from China, and a lot of it is subject to tariffs, tariffs that go back to the trade war President Trump started 2 years ago. Chad Bown is an economist who researches trade and international agreements. So we can't redo the past 2 years, Chad, but in theory, would we have less of a shortage of medical equipment if we never had these tariffs in the first place?
I think the answer to that is clearly yes. There's a number of products that the Trump administration, when they were deciding what to impose tariffs on and what not to impose tariffs on over the last 2 years, the American medical community, a lot of instances came ahead and said, you know, try to avoid these. And in many instances, the Trump administration didn't. And so you end up with, you know, 25% tariffs on things like, you know, oxygen concentrators and thermometers and disposable medical headgear. You have 10% tariffs on a lot of protective clothing, or 15% tariffs even. And that, I think, made it difficult for buyers, American hospitals, to prepare for, you know, a pandemic like we're seeing today.
We should point out that the Trump administration did announce, quietly announced earlier this month, that some of these tariffs on medical supplies would be temporarily reduced to deal with the coronavirus when it charges onto American shores. Now it is here. So was that too little too late?
Well, I think it was definitely a step in the right direction. We want to get rid of these tariffs and make it easier for American hospitals to be able to get access to whatever supplies they need from wherever they might need them from. But I also think that it is a bit of a mea culpa by the administration, sort of recognizing that they have made it more difficult for the American medical community. You know, hospitals and doctors and nurses, they need this stuff right now. And it seems to be a lot to asking them to kind of go through this bureaucratic process to ask for some tariff to be removed when they really should be focusing their time and energy and efforts on other things.
Well, you kind of put your finger on it, Chad. Time is of the essence. So what does the U.S. need to do right now? Play nice with China, make more medical supplies here, or turn to other countries like Mexico? I mean, they rank second in medical equipment bought by the U.S.
Yeah, I think we need to do all of the above. I think no one knows how this is going to play out over the long term. The Trump administration, it needs to be thinking of creative ways to incentivize American production. We also, though, I think, do need to make nice with China and decide that, well, you know, some of the priorities that we were worried about 6 months ago or a year ago in fighting the trade war, maybe we need to put some of those on the back burner And this is really actually much, much more important. This is about life and death. We need to get these supplies from wherever we can get them, you know, as quickly as we can get them.
Chad Bounds, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You're with The World. Hey there, public media fans. We know you value what we do here at The World, but it costs a lot of money to bring you these important stories, needed context, and critical voices from the front lines in our interconnected world. These days, more than ever, independent, fact-based journalism provides the information you need to get through your day and plan for the future. We're asking you now to help support it. Go to theworld.org/give. Become a monthly supporter of the program that informs, educates, and connects you with our changing world. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Let me steer your attention to a story that is not about the pandemic. In Washington, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has been making some threats against international criminal prosecutors, and that has sparked widespread outrage. The World's Roopa Shenoy explains.
Before I tell you what U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said, here's the context.
All right.
Earlier this month, the International Criminal Court, or ICC, met at The Hague in the Netherlands.
The International Criminal Court is now in session.
It overturned a decision made by a lower court and gave the ICC prosecutor's office permission to investigate possible war crimes by Afghan fighters, members of the Taliban, and American forces. The decision was welcomed by the ICC's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda.
The many victims of atrocious crimes committed in the context of the conflict in Afghanistan deserve to finally have justice. Today, they are one step closer to that coveted outcome.
Bensouda says there is reasonable basis to believe members of the U.S. military and the CIA tortured and raped detainees. The U.S. government strongly opposes an investigation. Last year, when Bensouda asked permission to begin the probe, the U.S. revoked her visa. Fast forward to Pompeo last week.
Turning to the ICC, a so-called court, which is revealing itself to be a nakedly political body.
Pompeo went on to call out two members of the ICC prosecutor's staff by name. He said they were driving an effort to use the ICC to investigate Americans.
We want to identify those responsible for this partisan investigation and their family members who may want to travel to the United States or engage in activity that's inconsistent with making sure we protect Americans.
In response, the ICC released a statement that pointedly called those comments by Pompeo threats. The court said it stands firmly by all its staff. Human rights groups expressed outrage, and six former U.S. officials who've handled questions of war crimes released a joint statement signaling their alarm. One of them is David Sheffer, who served as the U.S. ambassador at large for war crimes issues in the Clinton administration.
This is an international court, and here you have the Secretary of State literally singling out staff members of that court publicly and threatening them. It is just beyond the pale.
Sheffer says there are lots of other ways the U.S. could have approached the situation. He says the U.S. could have showed the court that it's done its own internal investigation of potential war crimes in Afghanistan.
We constantly tell everyone that we investigate our own, so let's demonstrate that we have done that.
Instead, Sheffer says Pompeo has put the court staffers and their families in danger.
The fact that they are threatening named staff and their families is something that dictatorships do.
Catherine Gallagher is working with the ICC prosecutor. She represents two individuals who remain detained at Guantanamo without charge.
I think it's really important to step back and remember why it is that the International Criminal Court is investigating, and that is because the Bush administration established a global torture program after 9/11, and over three administrations, no one has been held accountable.
Gallagher says if people don't speak out, the Trump administration's intimidation campaign will escalate. The State Department didn't respond to requests for comment. For The World, I'm Roopa Shenoy.
How might one global crisis offer lessons for an altogether different one? I'm talking about the coronavirus pandemic that's sweeping the globe and that other slower-moving danger of climate change. Some people are already drawing a parallel between the two. Otto Scharmer researches science and social change at MIT. He says that when people all over the world focus on one thing at the same time, almost anything is possible.
What we see is profound changes in habits and behaviors. We see mobilizing of massive resources, $100 billion here, $1 trillion there, whatever it takes. We see the changing and enforcement of regulation on a level of global coordination that we haven't seen before. All of which, of course, is highly relevant to climate action.
So is it frustrating to you that this kind of change seems to happen when it's suddenly a life or death situation? I mean, so is climate change, but slow motion versus fast motion.
I wouldn't say it's frustrating. I think it's just interesting that it's possible at all. We see actually the moment we focus on such a key issue, there's nothing we couldn't get done within weeks or months.
We've talked a lot on the show about how different governments have reacted to the virus. What do you think all these different responses from China to Italy to Singapore to the United States, what does it teach us about how individual governments and leaders should best be tackling climate change?
There's a couple of learnings that we already have from the last few weeks. Yes, we do need centralized government action in order to be effective in addressing these slower or faster moving issues. We also saw that if you have incompetent people at the core, the more centralized government can actually turn into a weakness.
So what about the mass mobilization we have been seeing? Like daily life has changed literally overnight. Is there any kind of way that speed might be harnessed for the slower moving and seemingly more abstract problem of climate change?
In general, I think the point is very clear. We need a centralized capacity to respond, and we need effective regulation. We need data-inspired citizen awareness and action. We need basically all the sectors working together. Business to kick in their creativity. We need citizens to rise to the occasion. We need all the sectors and all the capacities in society to work together. When you really break down the response to COVID-19, that you really deal with all the issues that we also face in climate change, including the issue of social justice. From a health perspective, of course, you need to make all the tests and everything else freely available for everyone, because no one is being served if that's not the case in a world that's so interconnected. And the same, of course, is true for climate action.
I mean, it seems coronavirus could be the fulcrum for that kind of justice, but that would be a huge change. So let me ask you, what kind of change do you hope this pandemic triggers in how we approach the climate crisis?
The climate crisis we are facing is essentially a crisis of an old civilization hitting the wall and a new way of organizing how we work and live together, wanting to take shape, kind of needing to be developed. A deeper question of reimagine, really, not only our personal lives, but the way we organize our economy, the ways we evolve our democracy, and the ways we shape our learning systems. Those are the conversations we should be having now that could put us into place to really take action around climate that is addressing some of the deeper root issues, and it's not just responding and reacting to the symptoms. COVID-19, it's a possibility, it's a forced upon moment of pausing that could help us to connect with that force, both in our personal lives, but also in terms of our collective agency.
Otto Scharmer is a lecturer at MIT and founder of the Presencing Institute, which focuses on societal change. Thanks for these thought-provoking ideas, Otto. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Marco.
News headlines are about a minute away. You're listening to The World. The Tokyo Games are in doubt, but aspiring Olympic breakdancers already have their eyes on 2024.
You know, maybe they're not into swimming, but they're into dancing, so this is like a perfect thing for them because now they have an opportunity as well.
Waiting for the break that finally came. That story's coming up here on The World. Parents stuck at home with kids and still trying to work, this next story is for you. China is several months ahead of us dealing with the coronavirus outbreak, which means several months ahead of us learning how to adapt and cope. That includes improvements to online learning for kids who can't go to school. In China, the entire school system is shut down. Rebecca Canther has some lessons from Shanghai.
These days, mornings at my house sound like this.
9 o'clock should be starting now. Don't complain.
The Shanghai Education Bureau's e-learning classes start every day at 9 a.m. sharp, and students watch their lessons all the way to 4:30 p.m.
I have to get dressed. That's one thing, and I have to have all my stuff. It's kind of like going to school.
That's Leona, my daughter. She's 7 years old and a second grader at a public school here. She's not quite used to this new style of learning. She misses her teachers and classmates. They haven't seen each other since school let out for winter vacation in January, just before the virus outbreak forced everyone here to stay indoors.
I'm waiting for you. That's
I'm
good.
Pregnant.
Good.
Sitting at the dining room table, it's hard for her to focus, especially because her little brother can't stay quiet.
And when I'm always doing my work, my brother keeps on doing the stuff that I want to do. Oh, yeah, he's just playing.
More than 300 million students in China, everyone from kindergartners all the way up to university students, are stuck at home trying to learn online. That's almost as many people as the entire population of the United States. This huge experiment got off to a rocky start. Jessica Kaufman, a Canadian teacher at a local school in Shanghai, says there wasn't any time for training.
I think for some people, it's just such a crash course. And the learning curve, especially in the first couple of weeks, was massive. It was like a learning cliff. And some people held on and some people fell off.
Schools are still scrambling to make it all work. Internet connections can be spotty. And teachers say they're working longer hours collecting and grading homework and preparing online materials. They've had to learn some things the hard way. Don't leave the door unlocked while giving an online lecture. Someone might walk in. And be careful not to use any words banned on the Chinese internet, or you could get booted out of class. A lot of teachers are also parents, and that makes things even harder. Zhu Min is a third-grade science teacher in Shandong province in northern China. We talked at 10 p.m. after her two kids had gone to bed.
One of my friends, they and their spouse are both teachers, and they're going crazy. Every day they're just begging for school to start again. I never wanted to go back to work so much.
They're not the only ones. Kids want to go back to school too. Luo Zihan is a sixth grader at a private school in Shanghai. He sits alone in his room and watches class on a laptop while his grandmother takes care of his four-year-old brother. He really misses school.
At school, between classes, we can talk with our friends. But at home, there's no one to talk to. It's really boring. At least I have my little brother nearby. I can play with him. But for the kids who don't have siblings, it's very lonely.
Millions of students in China face an even greater challenge. They're preparing for high-stakes entrance exams. Li Jingjing lives in Shanghai with her 14-year-old daughter, who's studying for exams in June.
It's a lot of work. She has six teachers sending assignments all through the day, and so there are many notifications. It puts a lot of pressure on them and the teachers. I don't think this is good for the children.
Jingjing doesn't want to stress her daughter out. But taking it easy isn't really an option.
I told her she doesn't need to do all the work if she's tired. But she's a very obedient student, and she doesn't want to be the only one who's not doing her classwork. Sometimes she's up till midnight doing homework.
Everyone agrees that online learning is really challenging, and some people wonder how effective it is. Zhu Min, the third grade science teacher, says when her school reopens, they may have to restart the semester.
The thing is, we can't really guarantee that our students are learning anything. The younger kids especially can't manage their own learning, so we don't know if they're getting anything out of their classes.
In the past few weeks, more schools around the world have shut down to prevent the spread of the virus. I asked Kathleen McLennan, a dean at a private school outside of Guangzhou, if she had any advice for communities just starting e-learning. Kathleen's husband is also a teacher, and they have two school-age kids. The two of them struggle to get their own work done while helping out their children.
My advice would be to keep it simple and absolutely to manage things so that you're taking care of your mental health and taking breaks and getting exercise and doing whatever it is that feeds your soul. Just make sure you have enough time for that also.
My advice? As your child struggles to focus and you struggle to get any work done, close your eyes, take a deep breath, and imagine that happy day in the hopefully not so distant future when your kid goes back to school.
Mom, I need your help.
This too shall pass.
I don't know how to write any of this, and I'm tired of writing.
For the world, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Russia says it's sending healthcare workers to help Italy. Italy has the highest reported number of deaths caused by the virus. Russia has reported just one death and fewer than 500 cases overall. Some doctors are skeptical of the official numbers coming out of Russia, including Anastasia Vasilyeva, the head of Russia's Alliance of Doctors trade union. She spoke with us from Moscow and says that many cases of COVID-19 are likely being classified as pneumonia.
You see that now in our country, we have real increase of pneumonia cases. Government changed a lot of hospitals into hospitals where only pneumonia cases are treating. In Moscow, now we have about 15 hospitals that are changed to treat pneumonia. And three hospitals where coronavirus is treated. Really, we can associate increase of pneumonia cases with the pandemic of coronavirus all over the world. So our test is not really very good. We have no enough tests. We have not good diagnostics to understand which pneumonia cases is not coronavirus, which is really coronavirus.
So Dr. Vasilyeva, to be clear, you believe that there are many more cases of COVID-19 than the ones reported, that many of those pneumonia cases may actually be COVID-19 cases. Is that what you're saying?
So I can only suppose. I can only suppose, because how can we have increase of pneumonia without increase of coronavirus all over the world? So, of course, I think that the quantity of patients with coronavirus is much higher than government says.
You put out a video about this, as well as the conditions that Russian health workers are working under right now. Are the health professionals in Russia and is the Russian health system prepared to take on this virus?
Our country is really very big, and we have no enough roads. And for coronavirus, it's very bad way to spread. This can protect in some way our people from coronavirus, and the speed of coronavirus spread, I think, will be much less than in Europe.
You're saying basically Russia is geographically predisposed to fighting this virus because
yes.
Everything is so spread out.
So we have no roads. How can coronavirus travel between towns and cities and villages without roads, without transport? So in Russia, to move from point A to point B, it sometimes is very difficult.
Of course, that doesn't mean that coronavirus will not spread at all in Russia. There are still flights, there are still trains.
Of course, it will spread, but not in such quick way as in China and Europe. And also, you see that this disease is really dangerous for elder people. But our elder people have no money to travel. They're sitting home. They're sitting in their villages, and they are very poor. This fact can protect our elder people from quick spread of this disease. But our health system is also very poor. So we have no enough hospitals, no enough medical staff. We have no fabrics to provide masks, protection costumes, and so on.
So what measures has Russia taken so far in limiting the spread of the coronavirus?
So you see that now the borders are closed. The schools are closed, the universities are closed, but the metro underground transport is opened. For me, it's a great surprise, and I think that it's the most dangerous source for spreading this infection.
Dr. Vasilyeva, you're the head of the Alliance of Doctors trade union in Russia. What do you need from the government to help contain this? What do you think Russia should be doing right now?
So, of course, Russia should protect doctors. the government should equip every medical worker with protection, with masks, costumes, and so on. It's very important. Every medical worker who go for a walk and go to the hospital and back home, he's really spreading this infection in the transport, in the metro, in the streets, everywhere. So the medical workers should be well equipped.
And you're saying today Russia is not prepared for that?
Of course. Some towns, there's only one a medical worker in reanimation, only one. He or she is working for four people.
Wow.
So it's very difficult to work even now without any pandemia.
Dr. Anastasia Vasilieva, the head of Russia's Alliance of Doctors Trade Union, speaking with us about Russia's response to COVID-19. Anastasia's in Moscow. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
As of now, the Tokyo Summer Olympics are still on. The International Olympic Committee says cancellation is not on the agenda, though one prominent member of the IOC says otherwise. And a postponement of the Games looks increasingly likely. Canada says that the Olympics continue in July. Their athletes are not going. Haley Wickenheiser is a five-time Olympian with Canada's women's ice hockey team. She took home four golds and one silver. Wickenheiser is also part of the International Olympic Committee's Athletes Commission. I asked her what challenges athletes are facing right now.
There's so many. If you look at the Olympic Games, athletes train for literally to the minute. Sports like swimming and track and field, gymnastics, these athletes are training and they know exactly the minute, the time of day they're going to compete. And then you work backwards from 4 years to make a plan to allow you to peak and be at your best at those moments. And that just is impossible given the state of our facilities and the training scenarios that exist. But bigger than that, the athletes, and we believe that in Canada, we're part of the collective community and putting ourselves as athletes out training and doing things that need to be done at risk ultimately puts many others at risk. And so I think it came down to doing what's right for the health of the nation and our citizens first, and then athletes and sports second.
Have you been in touch with Canadian athletes who were training for the Summer Olympics, and what have you heard?
Yes, I have. Canadian Olympic Committee Athletes Commission is a liaison for athletes across the country. We've been in constant contact every day. Essentially, the majority of athletes were on side with this. There's a few that are asking why and wondering, but like I said, it's been a very collective decision, devastating decision. I think athletes are heartbroken. Athletes are going through a lot of emotions. There's a lot of athletes that this may have been their last Olympic Games. I've heard from psychiatrists dealing with athletes that athletes are undergoing a lot of stress and anxiety in dealing with this in the unknown. But in the end, I think the overwhelming direction was we need to do this. It's the right thing to do.
Olympic performance can often lead to some pretty tasty sponsorship deals. I mean, will there be an economic kind of knock-on effect from this?
I think there's a lot of fear and uncertainty around that. I think if I was still an active athlete and competing, you know, I would be, you know, my livelihood came from sponsorship. It came from everything that goes into the lead up to the games. And oftentimes your performance and your impact at an Olympic Games basically feeds and fuels you for the next 4 years in terms of a financial way to live. This is very scary. And this is real for a lot of athletes. You know, will my sponsors be able to stay on board with me? Is there going to be an Olympics? When is it going to be? All of these questions out there that I think we as a nation of sport, as Canadian Olympic Committee and myself at the IOC, we have to advocate for, that these are real stressful issues for athletes that will impact not only their sport, but their day-to-day life and their ability to feed their families.
Yeah, as to the when part of that equation, do you think the Olympics will just be canceled, or are you hoping for a postponement? What do you think will happen?
Well, the IOC has said cancellation is not an option, and I believe that that's the right option. I think postponement is what we're looking towards, and by all accounts, it's 2021. It's looking like a year is choice A in discussion right now, but knowing that, I think it would be premature to speculate on when it will happen. We have to give the IOC a little bit of time now to get their stakeholders on side, to speak to the Japanese organizing committee, and people need to understand that, you know, the Olympic Games are the hardest sporting event in the world to organize. There are so many logistics that go into this. Planning happens, you know, 8 years out of the games, and it's a huge blow to the Japanese organizing committee, but everybody has to work on side now to find the best way forward and be part of the solution to make the games happen whenever that will be.
Canada is the first country to pull out. How do you think the rest of the world should respond? And if there's kind of a domino effect here, how would you feel about that?
we are going to see more countries say, hey, we have to push this thing and we have to do what's right. And I think that Canadians and Canada should be very proud about this decision. I think it's the right one, and we're on the right side of history with this.
Hockey star Haley Wickenheiser is a Canadian 5-time Olympic champion. She's also part of the IOC's Athletes Commission. Haley, thank you very much.
Thanks.
As you've heard, the Summer Olympics in Tokyo are in limbo. Some athletes are already looking past Tokyo to the Paris Olympics in 2024. Swimmers, runners, also surfers and rock climbers, even breakdancers. All part of a push to make the Games more hip, to appeal to a newer, younger audience, introducing new events. The World's Sarah Birnbaum went to Silver Spring, Maryland to check out the Northeast Breaking Regionals, the first qualifying tournament for Team USA.
The theater is dark and packed with people. Hip-hop is pounding from the loudspeakers. There's a parquet floor up front marked up with tape, kind of like a basketball court, but much smaller. It's red versus blue, one-on-one. The competitors face off in the middle, dropping down to the ground, kicking their feet in the air, spinning on their heads. The judges watch from the sidelines, scoring them on things like footwork, power moves, and musicality. At the end of the judges' table, Antonio Castillo is scribbling notes. This whole competition was his idea, and more breakdancers are participating in these kinds of tournaments as they eye what's happening with the Olympics.
There's a new energy in the air that I think people are excited about, especially with the kids having now an Olympic dream. You know, maybe they're not into swimming, but they're into dancing, so this is like a perfect thing for them because now they have an opportunity as well.
Antonio was a kid like that. The first time he saw somebody breakdance, he was 5 years old living in Mexico.
My cousins put on a little family show like everyone does, right? And they were spinning around, they were listening to, you know, American music. And I thought it was cool, and I like how people were paying attention to them, and I thought I wanted to get some of that attention.
And so he did what little kids do. He copied them.
And this just happened to be around the time when, you know, breaking was like a big thing in the United States. It was like all the movies were coming out in the 80s. Here we come.
In Mexico, Antonio wasn't exposed to those movies. But then he saw some guy on TV named Michael Jackson doing a moonwalk, which is actually borrowed from breakdancing, and Antonio was obsessed. His mom found a videotape of Michael Jackson where he's dancing and wearing all these chains.
She bought it for me for my birthday, and then I never stopped dancing after that.
Antonio had no way of knowing then that breakdancing would become his lifeline. When he was 9 years old, his dad announced that the family would be moving to the U.S. Next thing Antonio remembers, he was yanked away from his village in the desert, a place with no roads, a place where people rode donkeys instead of cars, he says, and plunked down in an apartment in Manassas, Virginia.
I didn't speak any English. I had no friends. It was hard to make friends. And then there wasn't that many Mexican people there. And so what do? I dance. I would dance in school. I would dance at parties. I would dance everywhere. That's all I would do.
There were times in the intervening years where Antonio tried to stop dancing. He says he didn't want to be the guy who danced and that's it. Problem is, he didn't know what else to do. He tried starting at least a dozen businesses. None of them worked. By the time he was in his 30s, he was broke.
I was living with my sister, and she was helping me out. I was, you know, financially struggling. I couldn't even afford a cell phone. I was like all the way at the bottom, you know, from trying.
It's a long story, but Antonio decided he was going to focus on doing the thing he was best at, dancing. One day, somebody saw him dancing outside on the sidewalk and offered him a gig. That led to teaching classes and then to running his own studio. Soon, he started to think, what if he treated breakdancing more like a sport, like taekwondo or karate? So, Antonio developed a color-coded ranking system for his students. But instead of cloth belts, he awards them shoelaces.
It goes no lace, white, green, brown, orange, and all the way up to black, right? And there's 10. The 10 laces are breaking, right? And
Antonio created a point system for judging. He came up with rules and regulations. He founded the Competitive Breaking League. Antonio says it's modeled on the NFL and NBA, and he began to organize tournaments around the U.S. Then, last year, when the International Olympic Committee announced that breakdancing might be added to the 2024 Summer Olympics in Paris, Antonio saw an opportunity to assemble a U.S. breakdancing team so when the time comes, the U.S. would be ready to compete.
And nobody has ever talked about creating an eligible USA breaking team. So I took it on. It's like my thing. It's in the back of, you know, it's on me, right? And I just feel like, you know, there's nothing anyone can do to stop it.
And nobody seems to want to stop it. There are leagues around the world preparing for potential Olympic glory. Right now, pundits say the Russians, South Koreans, and Japanese are the ones to beat. And that's what brings us back to this competition, the Breakdancing Northeast Regionals. The winners here go on to compete at nationals, and then the top scorers will form the USA team. Now, there are still a lot of steps between that and sending an American team to the Olympics, and the Breakdancing Olympics might not even happen in 2024. There's still one more vote scheduled for December. But the way Antonio sees it, it's only a matter of time.
Regardless whether it's in 2024, 2028, if you've seen what I've seen, there's really no way that it can now become an Olympic sport. It's just impossible. Breaking is cool. Breaking has a life. Breaking has a heart. There's people doing it. There's kids all over the world practicing it. And it's the, you know, sport of the future. And I think that's the most beautiful part about the whole entire thing.
For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Just don't break dance in a big group. There are so many unanswered questions about the coronavirus pandemic and how it will impact the U.S., how we should be preparing for it. Tomorrow at noon Eastern, Dr. Paul Bittinger from the Harvard School of Public Health will be joining the world for a Facebook Live Q&A. Dr. Bittinger is an expert on emergency preparedness. Put your questions to him right now on our Facebook page, then join the conversation live at noon Eastern tomorrow. All right, let's get back to the breakbeat. Old school style, from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We know you're sitting tight, right? We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.